Our next speaker is Dr. Susan Seibold Simpson. She is an assistant professor at the Decker School of Nursing at Binghamton University in New York, She holds a PhD in health practice research from the University of Rochester, an MPH from the University of Albany, and a BS, MS, and FNP from Binghamton University. She practices in women's health and has an area of research on community impacts on health, particularly focusing on reproductive health in women and adolescents. Today she'll talk on social disorder, social cohesion, and adolescent health behaviors. Thank you.
Good morning. I just want to give a shout out to my colleagues here because I'm anxious and I've been doing this for a really long time. I just got to say they rock. Thank you very much. So I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues, Mark Jambon, who is a doctoral student in psychology, and Dr. Hugh Crean and Dr. Rich Kripe. I have no disclosures. I also want to acknowledge the City Department of Recreation and Youth Services, my other colleagues at my university, all the youth that participated in our study. We do have OAH grant funding, and I need to acknowledge a disclaimer, which is that contents are solely the responsibility of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of the Department of Health and Human Services or the Office of Adolescent Health. They feel strongly about that, and I want to make sure I get that in there. So how many of you are familiar with the issue of teen pregnancy? Oh, thank goodness. Okay, because I didn't do a lot of background because I really wanted to get right into results. But as you may know, Healthy People 2020, the target rate for adolescent pregnancy for girls 15 to 17 is 36.2 per thousand. Currently in upstate New York for girls 15 to 19 in 2011, our rate was 31 per thousand. In the project community, our adolescent pregnancy rate is 108 per thousand, and particular zip codes within our city can be up to 158 per thousand. So adolescent pregnancy is a huge concern in the city that I'm working in. Just to add a caveat to that, we also have high birth rates, with adolescent birth rates up to 99.3 per thousand. In 2010, the Office of Adolescent Health offered funding for replication of evidence-based programs to reduce adolescent pregnancy. Our local city government developed a grant to be submitted to the Office of Adolescent Health. The university was contacted to be their rigorous evaluator, and the city is working with a variety of community-based organizations to develop the intervention. So at OAH, they had 75 grantees presenting 23 different evidence-based models. There were 18 for the Teen Outreach Project, which is the grant that we are also implementing. How many of you are familiar with the TOP program? Sweet, good, excellent. TOP is, or at least was originally developed to be a school-based intervention for students grades 6 through 12. The outcomes from TOP have been shown to prevent school failure and to reduce adolescent pregnancy. It is an intensive program. It's 9 months long, so it follows the entire academic year, and its focus is on positive youth development. So there's a service learning component as well as classroom activities. But one of the interesting pieces of the TOP program is that we have a sense of how it works, but not necessarily why, which gave us a wonderful opportunity to consider what exactly is going on. However, as I noted, OAH is doing evidence-based interventions, and through randomized controlled trials, the TOP program has been shown to be statistically significantly likely, as compared to a control group, to reduce experiencing or causing a pregnancy, as well as being suspended from schools or failing a course. The how it works in evaluations by Allen and his colleagues, a lot of it has to do with the actual implementation of service learning or volunteer experience in the community. And what they found is that with younger students, if they had the opportunity to select the projects and that they found it enjoyable to provide the service learning, that it challenged them to think about future goals and taught them new skills, they were more likely to have positive outcomes. So it wasn't just the hours of time they spent doing service learning, but it was actually that process of coming up with a project and implementing the project and then reflecting on it that led to the positive outcomes. So currently, we're providing the teen outreach program in a series of city recreation centers. It was cluster randomized by recreation center, so we're currently in 11 rec centers throughout the city, and 6 of those rec centers are receiving the teen outreach program. The control groups are receiving a work readiness program. The data that I'm presenting today are from our first pilot year, and it's strictly the baseline data. I don't have any outcome data at this point in time. This is our theoretical model that suggests why service learning and the Teen Outreach Project make a difference for outcomes. So as you can see, that we look at effective service learning opportunities as well as other youth development asset building opportunities. These contribute to both internal and external assets, which leads to increased thriving and reduced risk. So that's a pretty consistent model for positive youth development. In addition, we as the researchers were particularly interested in Bronfenbrenner's bioecological model of youth development. Bronfenbrenner's model suggests that not only are youth at the individual level affected through development, but that they work within a series of systems, including their mesosystem, their exosystem. So the mesosystem is your neighborhood and your community, the exosystem is the larger governmental systems, and then the macro system is your societal influences. And youth interact with each of these systems and are impacted by as well as impacting those different systems. So for me, as a public health nurse, I'm most interested in the mesosystem. I'm really, really interested in neighborhoods. I've been a nurse practitioner for 25 years, and I've had a lot of opportunity to work with youth whose families are challenged by not having enough time in the day to have a job and raise their families. And so I was particularly interested in what communities can do to help youth be successful and thrive. So when we put together our surveys, we have a really, really long survey, and we always have to apologize to the kids when we start. It takes about 45 minutes for them to complete the baseline, and they complain bitterly. They'd get a $10 gift card, so at least there's a little bit of incentive. But we have a series of individual measures, family measures, peer measures, school measures, and neighborhood measures. And today I'm going to be talking about some of the neighborhood measures, specifically neighborhood disorder and collective efficacy, more specifically social cohesion. Collective efficacy is a concept that was developed by Rob Sampson in the Project on Human Development in Chicago. And it has to do with neighborhoods and how well do you know each other, talk to each other, trust each other. That's social cohesion. Social control is, do adults look out for kids? Do they step in if kids are engaging in risk behaviors? Together, those two subscales are a larger construct of collective efficacy, which is neighborhoods working together to reduce adverse outcomes. These are the items that measure social disorder. We did the survey initially on ACASI, but we had to move to a paper and pencil survey, so this is a screenshot. And so you can see there's physical as well as social aspects, but it's talking about trash and litter on the street, noise, homes and commercial buildings are well maintained, graffiti, vacant or burned out buildings, street signs and street lights being maintained, roaches or bed bugs, and air quality. So youth choose between strongly agree to strongly disagree. I'll tell you right up front, they had no clue what we meant by well-maintained, and so we had to be consistent as we went through providing the survey to make sure they understood that it meant that it was taken care of in their community. These are the measures of social cohesion. So again, so it was a four-point scale between strongly agree and strongly disagree. So people in my neighborhood generally get along with each other, look out for each other, are willing to help their neighbors, can be trusted. People in my neighborhood share the same values or beliefs, and people in my neighborhood socialize together. The outcomes that we're talking about today have to do with delinquency and sexual behaviors. We're also looking at prosocial behaviors, drug and alcohol use, and a couple of other outcomes, but today I'm just focusing on those two particular outcomes. So in terms of delinquency, these come from the YRBS, so my colleagues are probably familiar with them. On how many days have you carried a weapon at school or outside of school? How many days within the past 30 days did you get into a physical fight? Stolen something from a store, gotten in trouble with the police, or damaged property just for fun. Our sexual activity measures are also from YRBS, but they are the measures that OAH is collecting across all the 75 programs. So they're going to be looking at the national level, how are the top programs doing in reducing adolescent pregnancy? So the questions are, have you ever had sex? And within the past 3 months, have you been sexually active? And that's vaginal, penile sex. Have you ever had oral sex? Have you gotten anyone pregnant or fathered a pregnancy? And have you had or fathered a baby? So as I mentioned earlier, we used ACASI, Audio Computer Assisted Survey. So the kids put the headphones on, sat at the laptop, listened to the questions, and entered their data. And all of the scales that I'm reporting on today demonstrated good reliability with a Cronbach alpha of 0.7 or higher. So the results. Our sample at baseline had 437 youth throughout the city, each of the 11 rec centers that we targeted. 56% were female, 87% were African American, with 20 reporting being Latino or Latino, and a mean age of 13.5. The range of the age in this particular sample was 11 to 19, but you can see it kind of skewed towards the younger youth. And in cohort 2, cohort 3, and cohort 4, we're only looking at youth between the ages of 11 and 14. In regards to delinquency, you can see that close to 32% indicated that they had been in a fight within the past 30 days. We do have a lot of gang activity in our city, so this is not surprising. The kids that go to the rec centers tend to be a little less likely to be engaged in gang activity, so rates are higher within the city. You can see that 13% indicated trouble with the police and 11% indicated carrying a weapon outside of school as well as vandalism. In regard to sexual activity, 38% of the youth admitted that they had been sexually active, and of this 167, 67% had been sexually active within the past 3 months. 113 youth indicated that they had had oral sex, and of them, 72 had had oral sex within the past 3 months. And 12% acknowledged that they had experienced or fathered a pregnancy, and then a small percentage had indicated that they had gone on to deliver a child. I like visual representation of my statistics. I find it easier to discuss as well as to understand. So this is my social disorder scale. So you can see the social disorder scale was presented in a range from 1 to 4 with a mean of 2.18, so a little less than half, indicating that their physical environment was poor. And this was all for all the youth. So you can see we have a nice normal curve here. In regards to social trust, again, a scale of 1 to 4 with a mean of 2.32, and again, a nice bell curve here. We were a little bit concerned because our rec centers are represented in lower socioeconomic communities that possibly we wouldn't have very good variation, but I was really pleased to see that youth within their communities can identify changes or differences in both social disorder and social cohesion. I lost a slide. Sorry about that. These are the data for the sexually active youth. And what you can see, what we did is linear regression. So we regressed the physical environment on whether or not youth were sexually active. And so the line with the triangle here is the older males. And then the line with the dark triangles is the older females. The line with the squares is younger males. And then the line with the squares here is younger females. So you can see that for younger males, living in a worse physical environment was contributed to being sexually active. So males reported higher rates of sexual activity than females in less cohesive neighborhoods, but there were no differences found in more cohesive neighborhoods. So this is the direct effect of the social environment. But when we moderated that by social cohesion, the guy said that they were sexually active in those less cohesive neighborhoods. But as we moved into those more cohesive neighborhoods where they knew each other, talked to each other, trusted each other, there weren't any gender differences. We also found that sexual activity increased with age, consistent with the national data, but only for those youth living in less cohesive neighborhoods. So youth that lived in more cohesive neighborhoods were more likely to be engaging in less sexual activity. The other outcome that we looked at was delinquency. And so we have several factors in this. So there's a whole bunch of different, it's a four-way interaction. But social disorder, predicted higher rates of delinquency in older males living in less cohesive neighborhoods. So in those neighborhoods where there weren't a lot of people talking to each other, trusting each other, if you added social disorder on top of that, they were more likely to be delinquent. So again, not rocket science here, but it certainly comes out very clearly that that neighborhood context, separate from the peers, separate from the family, is having a direct effect on the youth engaging in the delinquent behaviors. And there was a gender difference. For females, less social cohesion was associated with greater delinquency. It didn't really matter how old they were or whether or not there was evidence of physical disorder. It was that level of social cohesion that was contributing to their engagement in delinquency. So again, here's your visual chart looking at this. These are just for the guys. So you can see as they move from a better environment to a worse environment, it doesn't like me. For the older boys with less cohesion, less likely to be delinquent. For the older in the more cohesive and the younger in the more cohesive, again, almost the same line. As you move to a worse environment, more likely to be delinquent. For this group here with the older, less cohesive neighborhood, substantial difference. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this line is going in the opposite direction, isn't it? So as they move, this is my older, more cohesive neighborhoods, older boys, more cohesive neighborhoods, as they move from a better physical environment to a worse physical environment, it's the better environment that has them being engaged in more delinquent behaviors. So for us, for some reason, our predictor was what we didn't expect. So it's an interesting question that we're going to have to explore further. Why did this happen? Is there more going on related to peers, which is my gut sense, but we have to measure it and look at the other variables to see if there truly is a relationship occurring there. But it's always exciting to say, it worked, but this is different. So science is messy, as my colleagues say. A couple of limitations to discuss. As my colleagues have noted, these are self-report data. So it's really important to understand that, first of all, some of our kids have had some questions with the level of the information that they were being asked to provide. So there may have been some concerns that they didn't understand or that they wanted to please us, even though we're very careful that the people collecting the data are not the people delivering the intervention. It is youth report versus adult report, and for those of you familiar with the collective efficacy literature, most of the time it's the adult saying whether or not people know each other, talk to each other. So these are the youth's perceptions of what's going on, and I'm hoping in subsequent years to be able to compare adult perception with youth perception. And of course, this is cross-sectional data, so no cause and effect can be determined from these data. This is a single point in time. So, discussion. How many of you are public health nurses? I'm just curious. Okay, so a small group of public health nurses. Those of us in the public health nurse section, as my colleagues demonstrated, were asked to talk about what does this mean to public health nurses. But it can really apply to social workers, educators, community residents. I use public health nurses because that's what I do, and that's the section that I'm presenting in. But when we think about where we are in day-to-day, and we think about what's happening in our communities, particularly our lower socioeconomic communities, it begs the question, is it worth trying to improve social cohesion within our neighborhoods? Is it worth having residents know each other, talk to each other, socialize with each other? And the data would suggest that it may be for the adolescents that are engaging or have the potential to engage in risk activities. So there may be some value in enhancing those relationships. One area that's particularly important to consider is, and I've been a public health nurse and a nurse practitioner for a very long time, and I spend a lot of time in my communities. Most residents will tell me if they don't know their neighbors or they don't talk to their neighbors, it's because they're concerned for their safety. If they get in someone's business, they might get injured or harmed, and that's an area that we need to be very sensitive to. So public health nurses can improve social cohesion if we feel that that's something that's of value. We can collaborate with our community residents, we can collaborate with our nonprofit organizations and other agencies that work in our neighborhoods. We can help build coalitions so community residents and organizations can get to know each other and can hear from each other and learn from each other. We can participate in existing networks, and we can help impact policy, because we have to be very careful not to blame the community residents if there isn't high social cohesion, if they don't take steps to change their neighborhoods, because they live and work within a structure which is established through government and through policy. And so community residents don't necessarily have the same degree of control that one might expect in higher socioeconomic neighborhoods. So we need to be working systemically to say, can we change policy? Can we change what's happening at the governmental level? Can we provide better street lighting? Can we provide safer communities, places for people to meet and not be concerned about harm? So policy is an important aspect. Likewise, as I mentioned at the beginning, I am particularly interested in what happens when our youth engage in service learning activities. Will that change their perception of the community? Will they feel that now that I've gotten to work within the community that the physical disorder is better or worse? Will they have a stronger sense of social cohesion? Will they meet residents, talk to residents, will they have more firsthand knowledge of what's happening? My hope is that through service learning activities, youth will have a sense of a greater sense of what's happening with social cohesion, and possibly that their activities help reduce disorder and improve cohesion. So we have our first cohort where we have baseline and immediate post-intervention data. We'll be starting our analyses. We will be doing data collection at baseline, post-intervention, at 6 months and at 12 months. Those are Office of Adolescent Health requirements. So not only do I want to know if it changes their perceptions of the community, but I'm also interested in seeing if this piece of the puzzle actually is associated with adolescent risk behaviors, as well as the protective behaviors like prosocial behaviors. So me personally, I'm really excited about this project, and other colleagues are really interested in their particular variables of interest, family or peers. But as a public health nurse, I really think it's critical to be looking at what's happening with our youth as they interact with their communities. This is our team, and I'm all done, so I would be happy to take any questions. Social trust is part of the social cohesion measure. So it includes, do people in my neighborhood get along with each other? Do they look out for each other? Are they willing to help their neighbors? Can they be trusted? People in my neighborhood share the same values or beliefs, and people in my neighborhood socialize. So it had a strong alpha, and like I indicated, there was decent variability, so I was really delighted with that.